Hello, friends, and welcome back to this episode of Textual Community, a podcast that explores the task of reading biblical texts in light of the canonical collection and within a confessional community. In this episode, I talk with Dr. Christopher Seitz about some of his recent work and also his pursuit of a canonical approach throughout his career. In our discussion, Seitz comments on some of the major developments in the field of Old and New Testament studies, his interaction with Brevard Childs, as well as the function of the biblical canon for the life of the churches. Thanks for listening. Today, I'm excited because Dr. Christopher Seitz is joining us on this episode to talk about some of his recent work in hermeneutics, the history of interpretation, and canon studies. So, Dr. Seitz, a warm welcome, and thanks for being here.
Thanks. It's good to be with you and your listeners.
Well, one of the aspects of your work that I've always found very helpful is some of the autobiographical sketches that you provide at strategic places. And these help you explain how you arrive at a certain position or help the reader see how you're approaching a particular exegetical issue or maybe a methodological problem. And most recently, you've done this in your opening section to your collection of essays on prophecy and canon, as well as throughout your book on convergences. So I thought maybe we could start here. When you think about your initial training and then subsequently some of your work in biblical and theological studies over the years, what would you say are some of the key turning points that stand out to you personally or within the discipline at large that were particularly significant? Or how has your own story shaped the way you've approached the study of the canon?
Well, you're right to mention that essay because in that I gave myself the freedom to take a kind of long view of my own intellectual biography and personal biography. I went to a small seminary, I guess it's not small, Virginia Seminary, and I had an exposure to typical of the day biblical critical scholarship, though the professor, he had studied in Germany like Childs had, and but he was a devout, rather pious man. And as I say in that essay, I had been introduced to Old Testament at Chapel Hill at a time when in my own upbringing, I really wasn't, my own Episcopal upbringing was constructive. My dad was a parish priest, but the Bible was chiefly known through the presentation of it in the context of liturgy, which prior to 1979 was fairly thin. One of the reasons I get into the lectionary at the end of that Convergences book has to do with the impact of the lectionary, which also changed the presentation of the scriptures in liturgical churches to a more full, orbed reading. But to go back to the period in question, it really wasn't until I went to Chapel Hill that someone was just telling us about the prophets, and that really brought the material alive to me. And it took time for me to see the limitations of that kind of approach. Though in the hands of the man who was deploying it, it was quite a productive, exciting reading. Now Chapel Hills is kind of associated with a very different brand of biblical scholarship. His name was Bernard Boyd. He wasn't well known, but he went to Union Seminary in Richmond, and John Bright was a friend of his, so it kind of came out of that era. When I went to seminary, it was a similar kind of training, and I have, you'll know by my name, I have German heritage, and I wanted to go to Goethe Institute in Munich in order to get German down, anticipating graduate studies. I had already thought through what I wanted to do professionally. And at the time, most of my classmates were going into ordained ministry, and I was ordained, but I wanted to go to graduate school, and my bishop was behind that. I went to Munich and studied with Klaus Bölzer there, who again was a kind of generous, productive, creative deployer of historical critical methods. He wrote a commentary on 2nd Isaiah. It was really his life's work. And then I went to Yale. I would say one of the early sort of mileposts, I wrote a pretty typical historical critical study of Jeremiah. Though I can see in it now, if I go back and look at it, I was trying to think through the consolidation of different reactions to the exile, mm-hmm. so that rather than setting them apart and distinguishing them in a hard way, one from another, and seeing their productivity in terms of how they contrasted, I was moving more toward understanding what their side-by-side effect in Jeremiah was. I wrote that dissertation under Robert Wilson, and at the time, Childs had published Introduction to the Old Testament of Scripture in 1979, and it wasn't a book that was positively received. People thought it was an attack on historical critical methods and so forth, and that carried along his commitment, in fact, to historical critical work. And then trying to move beyond it. Notable in his seminars was he never talked about his own work, and he didn't really talk about his own ideas. Hmm. He wanted the graduate students to understand historical critical methods, and you could pick up from him where he thought the limitations were, but he thought it was his responsibility to do that. And come to the first milepost, I went to teach in Philadelphia. I hadn't finished my dissertation yet, and it was important to take a job if you could get one. You'll know about that. And I taught at the Lutheran Seminary, and I remember from my own upbringing in the parish, my dad, you know, preached every Sunday and things, that it wouldn't be helpful to Lutheran students preparing for seminary to give them too much theory of composition and all. It just didn't seem to be usable in any direct way in the pulpit. And I think your listeners may well also be aware of what it means to learn a certain set of things in seminary or theological training that then really are very difficult to move into preaching mm-hmm. or teaching at parish. And so I remember very clearly picking up Introduction to the Old Testament and Scripture for the first time, because at least it was dealing with the contents of the Bible in their totality. And it was possible to give a lecture on Haggai and not get weighed down in how much of the book is Haggai's and so forth and so on, because Childs was sensitive to those things, but he wanted the Bible in its final form to have priority. Now, that's a long time ago, and I think the field has moved on to take that more seriously. But honestly, at the time, it was not a popular way of thinking about things. And I wouldn't say the scales fell from my eyes. It was more a matter of the practicality. I felt responsibility to train people in a way that was more directly, I thought, usable for sermon preparation and teaching. So I think it's important to say that I was aware that Childs was very controversial. I remember going to an SBL meeting, Society of Biblical Literature in New York City, and it was all the greats, Brueggemann, Mays, all these people, and they were all really struggling to accept what Childs was trying to do. And so as a graduate student, you know, you didn't want to kind of get behind someone as a teacher who looked like, you know, that just wasn't necessarily where the heart of the field was. And he was sensitive to that, which is why he continued not to push his own ideas. I would say the next thing would be Isaiah studies. The regnant model of Isaiah 1, Isaiah 2, Isaiah 3 was losing its power of persuasion. It was always more complicated than that. And so I got involved, and sometimes, Chad, I think one of the reasons that you do things is you're given the opportunity to do them. You know, I was given an opportunity to write a commentary on Isaiah 1 to 39. I think whoever had been given it had dropped out. And I was already not interested in just writing a commentary on one Isaiah, but there were no series that were doing the whole book of Isaiah. Mm-hmm. And I had written a second book on the unity of the book of Isaiah called Zion's Final Destiny, but I had to take what was given me. And so then I wrote a second volume in a different commentary entirely, New Interpreter's Bible, because there again, the New Interpreter's Bible was not treating Isaiah as a whole book, even though the format would have lent itself to that. And I would say the third thing was related to teaching the prophets. When I went to St. Andrews, I had the part of the teaching. My other colleague there did another part. I had prophets in wisdom, and I had lost confidence in the chronological popular model. Start with Amos, go to Hosea, then you do first Isaiah, and then you move to, and you set up a grid and you end with Malachi or Joel or something like that. I just didn't, it was losing its persuasiveness to me. And so I started doing things different. I would start with Jonah, just to be perverse. And it was also a fun book to read and break people into it. I realized that getting into Isaiah is three books, but yet one book was kind of complicated for the classroom. And I put that off to the end. And I wrote, as you will know, a series of books, then Prophecy and Hermeneutics, a new approach, a new manner of interpretation. And I think there's a place where Childs, you ask about Childs. Childs reviewed that book and blurbed it. I was doing things that were congenial to his thinking, but he saw his out beyond the way he had been trained. And I think he was a little nervous about people seeing too much canonical coherence when he didn't think it was warranted, and he didn't want to become a structuralist. I wouldn't use the name John Salehammer in vain, but I think he had a kind of sense that that way of doing things, where you sort of pushed aside the historical critical dimensions fairly resolutely, was not what he wanted to be associated with. So he never did anything with the unity of the 12. He basically had enough on his plate, I think, to argue for the final form of Hosea, the final form of Joel, the final form of Amos. So that was a place where I was beginning to push the boat out a little bit. And he would always push me, which I was happy to agree with him on, that the diachronic, the compositional historical dimensions needed to be factored in to the way you thought about the final form of the book. I tend to tell my own students, because I also run them through the paces, historical critical methods are properly preliminary, provisional, and partial. They can show us certain things that are probably true, but their main contribution is then helping us, therefore, appreciate the final form of the material. And not every age has bequeathed to itself historical critical methods, but ours has. And I think there's a reason for that culturally and intellectually, the rise of historicism, the natural sciences that didn't affect the sixth century interpreters or the reformers in the same way. I think Childs felt there was a responsibility to live in our own age and to take its questions seriously. And having done that work, which really involved seeing the prophets in relationship to each other, I then took on Colossians because I thought the Pauline letter collection offered a similar kind of thing. Some prophets are highly occasional. You can sense their historical location and occasionality, just like you can in First Thessalonians or a letter like the Corinthian correspondence. Other letters, like the prophets, look like they're meant to function more generally. And Colossians, I would put in that category. Paul's never been to Colossae. He doesn't know anything about it, but what Epaphras has told him. And therefore, and at the end, it says, when you're done reading this letter, give it to the church at Laodicea. Mm-hmm. So obviously, whatever he's concerned about at Colossae, he thinks is not going to be incoherent to another congregation. Well, I don't live there, so those are not my problems. But I thoroughly enjoyed that work. And I was concerned personally that the Brazos series was producing a lot of weird volumes by theologians, Howard Wass and others, that were, you know, just banging their own drum. How can you turn Matthew into a pacifist? I mean, it just didn't seem to make any sense. So I asked Rusty Reno if I could write a commentary. And I said, I'm not a theologian, but I'm not a New Testament scholar, so I will jump over and stir the pot from another direction. And I said, look, I know the Old Testament real well, and that makes me a friend of Paul's, who also knew it real well. I'm not sure New Testament people know the Old Testament as well as Paul does, and they shouldn't be writing letters on it. You know, then Elder Testament, at this point, I had moved to France and was living there, and my wife was ill, and I had time. One of the blessings I've had in my career, Chad, and you'll appreciate this, I think, is I've chosen to take positions that would allow me to only teach graduate students and that would allow me to write. And sometimes it's some financial hindrance to me, but it's what I felt called to do. And I've never been very good at feeling cramped in a job that I didn't like. And so when I went to Toronto from St. Andrews, it was my contract that I was able to only teach graduate students and be given time to write. And I was doing other things at the time as well. I was working at a church in Dallas. And so Elder Testament came out of that. And that was, for me, an effort to consolidate a good deal of thinking and to strike out in ways we might want to pursue. But the book I most thoroughly enjoyed was Convergences, the one to which you refer. I'm disappointed the book hasn't been reviewed enough. But then again, I just got a review yesterday from SBL on Elder Testament. So, you know, there's a lag time on these things.
Right.
Steve Cook at Virginia Seminary is quite a good review. I didn't pay him. It's good. But Convergences really represented an exciting, sort of exhilarating place for me. I've been teaching in Paris, and I just culturally, I was encountering kindred spirits to Childs and others, and they had not been noted. We can talk more about that book, but those were, I've always moved around, you know. I get restless. If I got an idea about the 12, Book of the 12, I'll write a couple books on it, and then I'll write a commentary. And I feel like I'm done. You know, I don't have anything else to say. I could write now on Malachi and some other things, but I don't. I've kind of figured out what I think about that. I don't know what I would do. I'm not sure what I would do now. I'm not teaching in the classroom anymore. As you know, to take a graduate student is a 5-year commitment. And so at some point you have to kind of decide, I'm not going to take any more. I'm going to try to wind down the ones that I have. I have 3 more graduate students in Toronto working on Ecclesiastes, Isaiah, and the phenomenon of canonical endings of books. I've had a lot of students working on Ecclesiastes, and I would be tempted to write a commentary on Ecclesiastes. It's an extraordinary book. I don't think has been well understood in the modern period. I think under the influence of people like Crenshaw, it's made out to be kind of a pessimistic book, which I don't think it is at all. So that's, you know, my current teaching and research. As you know, I lost my wife rather tragically to COVID, and I found that when that happened, you know, I wasn't really interested in continuing at the same pitch. Now, I was coming to a kind of conclusion. I collected my essays and they were published, and there was a volume in my honor. And I don't think I've been given to know what to write by God. I mean, to me, those things come to you. At least for me. And then you kind of take dictation. I don't want to overemphasize that, but I think something will arise in my spirit that I feel I need to resolve. Or I feel like I'm on to something. That Convergences book, I was very interested in Vatican II and what I saw as lost potential for convergences across denominational lines. And a lot of that was born of, we worshiped in the Catholic Church in France, which was not like any Catholic Church I've ever encountered. Very ecumenically oriented, has great intellectual tradition. It's got some very super charismatic and Catholic movements. Chemin Neuf, the new path. And there's a sort of spirit that I sense there, Teze, that is unique in my experience. And so I had been placed down there. My wife needed a lung transplant, and we were not sure she'd live. And we moved to France, and she did get a lung transplant, but it put me in the midst of a context that I never would have anticipated going into. I'd spent time in Germany and Scotland and other places, and I didn't really know anything about the way theology or biblical studies was being handled in France.
Mm-hmm.
So that, that's a good long clip. I'm a talker, so you'll just interrupt me and I'll stop.
Oh, no, that's good. Yeah, so you mentioned your Convergences volume, picking up some of the themes, your major themes of Elder Testament, but also seeking to show how a canonical approach intersects and resonates with several other types of projects that are somewhat surprising scholarly and social locations that you've already kind of mentioned. So maybe let's talk about some of those convergences that you noted and why you think they're significant. Thinking about even just the direction that historical critical work was going with Martin Note and Von Rod at the end of their career, coming to see the importance not only of different traditions or sections of text, but the effect of their combination, which is very much the insight that yourself and Childs have been thinking about. And then moving from that scholarly context to a much more local context of thinking about the lectionary readings that were, I think you call them an on-the-ground example of something like hermeneutical or canonical Catholicity, as different traditions and denominations are reading and prioritizing the reading of texts, but text across the canon that kind of forces you to think in terms of different kinds of association that's at work in the scriptures as a two testament witness. So what are some of your favorite insights or things you talked about in that volume?
You've mentioned some names, you know, that were household names to me. I studied in Germany, and I remember reading the Pentateuchal study of Note in German. And the, if you know that work, Überlieferungsgeschichtliche Studien, quite a mouthful, it's mostly an effort to painstakingly tell us which verse is J and which is P and so forth and so on. Now, it was in the hands of a master. I don't know how he kept his cigar lit. You know, there was a lot of technical work in there. But I must never have read the end of the book where he talks about the achievement of conjunction. That is what it meant for the Bible as we have it to not be content to set these things off as though they're in silos, but indeed we have a productive final form that that is worthy of our attention. It's almost like the Sunday school teacher came back in his frame of reference. But I would say this, I don't think he thought it was an unnatural move. It's just that the achievement of the main part of the book was where most of his labor was, and his thoughts at the end were hermeneutical. Now, I had already made some observations about Von Rod, because in the Genesis commentary, which was the last major thing he wrote, he had already commented in the second edition, I think it was, that he had not paid enough attention to the achievement of the conjunction of sources. And he comments about, well, you know, have I not paid enough attention? The very good of creation is followed by the fall of man, and these things together produce an effect. Now, Ricoeur and others that I was noting had also been walking down these trails, but it was because Beauchamp was quoting these people in French, and I thought, well, now, wait a minute, I don't remember that part of Martin's notes. I went back and looked, but this is a perfect quote. I mean, this sounds like right out of Childs. The question is whether this combination of sources has not resulted, perhaps unintentionally, in unexpected narrative connections and theological insights, and hence whether in the final analysis, the whole has not become greater than merely the sum of the parts. And then he uses the word Holy Scripture. And I, you know, had missed that. And even the idea that a conjunction of things will create an intentionality that isn't necessarily the kind of intentionality being sought by historical critical method. You're trying to figure out what the mind of the author is, what his intentions are. And, you know, I discovered that Beauchamp had already rejected the idea. Why would it be? Why is it that what an author wants to say has to coincide with what he knows? Now, I have the French quote in there. That's a very interesting idea. And in a way, it lines up with Origen and some of the early church fathers, that biblical authors are given to say something that's intelligible to who they're talking to. But because God is the one giving them what is being said, there's always a surplus to what they entirely know in their frame of mind. Now, this also helps you negotiate things like Psalm 22. When Calvin says Psalm 22 reaches into the passion narrative, he isn't saying that David had that in mind. That would be to kind of psychologize David. When he uses the phrase prophesies, what he means is that what he's given to write down has an intentionality more than he could know in his own time and place. That's why for Calvin, the psalm is about David. But on the other hand, counting all his wounds and where was David coming under all this kind of persecution of this kind of extreme sort? Well, somewhere, but we don't know it, but it obviously had a later referentiality. So I was finding these things somewhat, as I say, by accident, in part because Beauchamp was using them for his arguments about conjunction. And my larger point there was, I think that if Von Rod and Child and Note had lived longer, they would have read Childs and said, yeah, this is where my mind is going. I've done all the diachronic work, but the hermeneutical work is out in front of me. I mean, Note didn't live a whole lot longer than that quote. Von Rod died in, I think, 68. Don't quote me. Your listeners can get it right. And Childs obviously lived into the 21st century. And I think Childs' European training always made him, I think, a bit of an outsider in the U.S., which is kind of interested in facts and proofs and the world of referent. You know, the Bible is referring to something, and that something is more important than the way the words go on the page. And that's almost a reflexive instinct, isn't it? I mean, people tend to think that the New Testament is a kind of best effort at pointing to something bigger than the gospel records, the real man, Jesus. And yet, really, no one ever really thought that way. You know, I mean, Second John would say, you know, we have what we know as it's put down before us, and that's who Jesus is, you know. I mean, and I get at that actually a little bit in the end of the book, where I look at the infancy narratives and I compare Benedict, Pope Benedict Ratzinger, in his Jesus of Nazareth book, because he's still operating a little like that, you know. Famously, Luke and Matthew, it's kind of hard to get them together, you know, unless, well, we just popped in for a circumcision on the way down to Egypt and stuff. In other words, the two accounts don't really, it's hard to get them to come together. Now, for Benedict Ratzinger, that's a somewhat of a problem to be worried about and thought through, much in the way that the Diatessaron or something would try to create a single narrative line. For Childs, the fact that they don't agree is great, and you shouldn't try to bring them together, because what the subject matter, what he would say, what they're concerned about, God in Christ, doesn't necessarily line up with what they choose to see. They're looking at different things. What Jesus did and said in the canvas of history was multiple. So everything is a selection. I think that's what the last line of John's gospel is all about. I suppose if the world wouldn't fill all the books that would be written. And not really until, I mean, when Calvin heard that verse, he said, oh, well, that's like the end of Ecclesiastes. You could write a lot of books, but this is the end of the matter. That's for him. Calvin said, that verse means you have everything that you need. It doesn't mean you only have a portion of what you need.
Right.
So I'm bouncing around a little bit, but I think, so on the first point, I was discovering these things that I thought were really fruitful. And it's another question entirely to ask, why didn't the field, who otherwise thought highly of Note and Von Rod, move to where they wanted to go?
Well, does this relate to one of the major emphases you have? It shows up in a variety of your works when you're thinking about that the Old Testament and the biblical narrative in general. You talk about the strange old book, the narrative world of the Bible is narrative, but there's a limit to narrative as a category because of the way in which biblical narrative functions. It doubles back. It goes one way and then comes back another, and that there's something about this particular way that the narrative unfolds that forces you to think in terms not only of the economic unfolding of salvation history, but the ontological points it's making about who God is. And it's part of the final form of the text itself that is causing you as a reader to think about those things.
Absolutely. You captured it really well. I mean, I couldn't say it a whole lot better than that. Thank you. I mean, you understand what I'm trying to say, that linearness, which our mind moves naturally toward chronos, its ability to move over into kairos, to use those kind of cliches, the horizontal and the vertical, the Old Testament and the fourfold gospel witness. I mean, that you're right to segue. That's why isn't there one gospel? Well, there are four. Why aren't there six? Because John said, we've had enough. This is more knowledge is not going to compel faith. These things are written in order that you might believe. And as you know, my view is that the last coda of John's gospel is actually all the things that could be written, is also a reference to the three preceding gospels. That I think he's aware that he's last. He has knowledge of his final position. In that sense, it's kind of like Chronicles. I mean, some would argue the Chronicles is aware of the entire range of the Old Testament, and he's saying, I'm going to say the last thing that's to be said. But on the point that you're registering, and some of that I got from Auerbach. I mean, that those essays remain, you know, what does Homer want to do? He wants to entertain us. He's going to give us a story. He's going to distract us from our modern world. And so we want to know, the thing about story is it's like a couch, you know, it allows us to ease into something and yeah, there's where it's going. And I guess I'm the final chapter, you know, where the Bible has story, but it keeps breaking it up, you know, and he said, you compare the sacrifice of Isaac with Homer. And he said, the text is tyrannical. I mean, it's basically demanding that we enter a world that is not like our world. You know, it's claim, as he says, its claim to reality is tyrannical. And you can't domesticate it, make it kind of conform to a story. If you want that, go to the movies. Even some good movies don't do that. So yeah, there was something about the literary character of the Old Testament that Diachronic Method had rightly seen. You know, the things jumping around here. You know, okay, let's say there's a P in Genesis 1 and then at 2:4 it's J. Well, it's kind of ragged there. You know, now at the time when the blah, 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 you know, they're trying to bring something off, and that's because they're interested in something other than this sort of tidy, seamless unrolling. They double back. They said, well, let me go over that. I didn't talk about that, but we also had man and woman. We had them separated. We had them given commandments. They disobeyed, so forth and so on. And no sooner than you think, well, I think I may deal with it that Von Rod had set it up so that, you know, if you extract J from P, you get this descending sinfulness that's interrupted by the call of Abraham. But if you don't do it that way, there's something to be said about that. You know, you've got Adam and Eve, clothing, Cain and Abel, mark, Noah, rainbow, Tower of Babel, no mitigation. No, wait a minute. What's the mitigation? We're calling Abraham. He's going to. So, I mean, he was seeing something by extracting that. But if you put it together now, you're going to see something more. What Note said, maybe even unintentionally. You'll have to stop me, but you know, Von Rod, he worried a little bit about this. It was sort of like, I'm going to be put out of business. I thought my best effort was with Jay. And now I'm saying that if you put it with P, it's even better. And he quotes at that point, it's a Jewish scholar who it was. And he'd said, yes, well, the redactor is actually Rabboni, our rabbi. And Von Rod got a little uneasy there. And I didn't, you know, if you read the book, you'll sense in me why, you know, why get uneasy? Finally, it is in our teacher who on the road to Emmaus tells us what this book is about that has indeed seen to its providential character and shape. But you can tell just from my own encounter, my own discussion of this, how much that book really juiced me up, because I was finding things that I didn't know were out there and they were kind of lost.
Right. I noted in your earlier discussions about just kind of the constraints that the disciplines that we're working in put on us in terms of, like, if you're thinking about the book of Isaiah as a whole, but the commentary series you're writing in, for example, doesn't treat it as a whole, you can only write. So then you're tasked with writing half a commentary or a full commentary on half the book from the perspective of the whole book. So thinking about the constraints of the discipline on that task. But then when you change your target audience of, for example, in the local churches, thinking about the task and the object of study shifts a little bit as you're trying to explain the meaning of texts and the way that they fit together for an audience who's seeking to understand the meaning of the text for formation and life and belief. So some of those, there's a connection there, but it definitely puts seeing the value of the final form of the text as formative for affecting or giving you a way of understanding and grappling with what's being seen in the the scholarship and the depth dimension that's there, but then also seeing it have formative impact in the textual community of the churches.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a good example would be Job. I mean, any reader, you could tell any alert person in sitting in the classroom at the church with you in adult education, and you say, looks like the first two chapters, you could see why people might say, well, you know, let's put that together with the ending, and we have Job the pious, and then we have a Job who goes off the rails. But, you know, and they can follow that argument. I mean, it makes a certain amount of sense. But then if you say, well, what's the effect of this? Well, one of the effects is we're being given to know something about this situation that Job himself doesn't know. And it, for us, that's also a burden. Why is God doing this? You know, Job's got his own version of that. Why are you doing this to me? Well, is it any easier for us who know why God's doing it? No, it's just a different challenge. Can we too say, is it possible to serve God for naught? You know, given what we know. And so so that diachronic dimension is actually quite live in the way the book's unfolding. We're going, this isn't fair, and that kind of thing. It's like, well, maybe it isn't, but let's watch Job and let's see how he's handling this. Before we get sympathetic for him, let's let him do his work. He may outshine us in the end, you know, and he may see things that we'll never see, you know. And in fact, he does. He sees things we'll never see. God takes him and shows him the recesses of a universe he can divulge. And if you start taking the book apart and just leaving the pieces on the table, you just don't get any of that majesty. And I think that's what Childs was tuned into. I had a line in one of those books, you know, they took the clock apart to see what time it was. You know, it's like
right.
The village idiot. So, and the lectionary, for me, let me just say a quick word about that, which your time is. For me, that was a really marvelous moment in that, in a way, Protestants and Roman Catholics, there was sort of like Paul's comment about making the Jews jealous and so forth and so on. I mean, it was the fact that Protestants had really lively biblical studies departments in the 19th century, 18th, 20th century, and Roman Catholics didn't. Their departments look fundamentalist, I think would be the word we'd use. And they were jealous of that at Vatican II. They gave permission for biblical scholarship to thrive. And then they created a lectionary, which ironically isn't very invested in historical critical methods. It was really more invested in the associations that were seen in the history of interpretation. And having done that, then the Protestants said, by the way, this is really good. So you had these collaborative efforts to make sure that, you know, this was an instrument being used in the church. My narrower argument on that, however, really in some ways has to do with the lectionary and the fact that it's used widely. But the other argument was coming out of Childs. He wrote that book on the struggle to understand Isaiah as Christian scripture. And it's an odd book in a way. He was always worried about it. He and I talked a lot about his work. And I read it and I thought, well, this is really good. It's really useful. It's kind of like a workbook. You can kind of work your way through, you know, from Origen to Irenaeus to Antiochenes, the Cappadocians. And we get a real flavor. Here comes Augustine and Aquinas. He didn't like that idea. He didn't want to write a workbook. And I said, so it was kind of hard for him to describe what it was he really wanted to say. And I think that he came up with this idea of family resemblance, that even though the Antiochenes and the Alexandrians represent poles of interpretation, they're both working with a text. And they're just prioritizing one thing over another. For the Antiochenes, they're kind of Semitic. They're prioritizing history, literal sense. The Antiochenes, the Alexandrians are seeing linkages that transcend historical flow. And then he said, but both of these people remained within the bosom of Christian interpretation, and some historical critical methods have blown out of that. He's aiming his fire at Brueggemann, I think, at that point. But at the end of the book, after having done this, he said something like, therefore, I can confess with the Church Catholic or something. I believe in one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. Now, it struck me as an odd thing to say without unpacking it. It wasn't just a piece of piety on Childs's part. I think what he was wanting to say was to pay attention to the whole history of interpretation. Christian interpretation, in this case, is to participate in the Catholic life of the Church. For him, Catholic there being defined as the universal course of interpretation and its Catholic character. He could have said more, seems to me, at that point. It was a little, just kind of threw it down at the end. It was like, what does that mean? Have you just come out of church? I mean, but I think that's what he meant. And I was trying to argue the same things, that Roman Catholics could recenter their understanding of Catholicity around the scriptures and their history of reception and build a bridge to, in many ways now in the U.S., evangelicals who are also interested. You know, one thinks of Tom Oden, Methodist, not evangelical, but the ancient Christian commentary series. You have these ressourcement movements of Baker. All the publishers want to get in on these things, of course. That there's potential there. And the last essay I've written was for Ephraim Radner, which is also on this theme. And I obviously was affected by French Catholicism, which was pushing hard. This is what happens in part because there were no more Protestants left in the country for all intents and purposes. Most of them were driven out. And the Protestant churches that are left are kind of sad. Don't know any other way to say it. And so I think there is a sense among Roman Catholics that they have a responsibility to be the church. And then for someone like myself to go to church and to hear the same liturgy, the same lessons, you know, it just kind of felt like there's more going on here. Why don't we try to build some fires around it? These are the kinds of things we need to be concerned about. It's hard in the United States because you open the yellow pages and you got 3,000 denominations. And okay, that's because we're the new world and we have people that have arrived from everywhere with all these different religious backgrounds. But I think, you know, and I can't speak for what it's like in your context, but the sense of honoring a very distinctive denominational identity, given that the world is a mess, starts to feel a little less decisive. The Reformed, I don't know if you're a Reformed school, they love to fight, so they'll always be fighting amongst themselves. They're bright. This is what happens when you're bright. You know, you were all right until that comma came in there, and now we're not so sure. That may never change. By and large, they're, you know, everybody's trying to, you know, get along, create Christian churches, feed people. Yeah. You know, and so a lot of times then, even the fact that one struggles a bit to define what their identity is, maybe not a bad thing, you know. And Wycliffe, where I teach, I'm not there often because of my position. We have half our student body is garden variety evangelical. We're not, you know, we have Anglican evangelicals, which is a small entity in the U.S., bigger one in Toronto, but...
in some ways, I tell my students that I'm training for ministry is, you know, that we have we have doctrinal distinctives, but if you can just get your people to read the Bible and value the Old Testament, you've done a good work.
Yeah.
So at that point.
And I would say alongside of that, I'm just speaking for myself, that a rule of faith of some kind as a threshold onto reading texts, a very simple one, one might be, we don't read texts in such a way that one be repugnant to another. And so we're going in thinking that. We're not playing Paul off Jesus or something like that. And the other one might be that Jesus Christ is the only mediator between God and man, and therefore, in both testaments, he's at work. One under signs and sacraments, the other in the flesh, or witnessed to by the apostles. Mm-hmm. With armed with a couple threshold rules, or rule of charity, like Augustine, you know, we're going to read the text in such a way that it improves our love of God and neighbor. Is at least in my experience, maybe not yours, because we live in a consumer culture, everybody with their Bible can also mean everyone with their own kind of private view of things.
Right.
And we got to have some kind of rule, regula. And it doesn't have to be complicated. Mm-hmm. Two or three things.
Yeah.
And as you know, there's a lot of discussion about what a rule of faith might be and and all. And I think that's right. We bring eyes to our reading that are formed by our church life and backwards. I mean, it's funny, you know, Calvin, when he wrote the Institutes of Christian Religion, it actually started out, it was quite thin. He wrote it as a way of indicating what the Protestant faith was in Geneva. It kept getting bigger. Why did it get bigger? Because he was also writing commentary. So he'd preach through the week, Old Testament, New Testament on Sunday. And then he'd say, oh, well, having read the text, I'm going to go back and rethink this or that and the other. But there was this reciprocal movement between rules or dogmatics and scripture reading. And it was always, I think, mutually informing. And I think any good thinker, Luther, Calvin, Childs, hopefully myself, yourself, it's always, you know, trying to keep these things in balance.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of the things I've appreciated about your work and thinking about the rule of faith that unites us being directly connected in some way to the character of the Christian scriptures as a two testament witness to Christ. And so I think that's a helpful orienting thing that connects both scholarship, but also personal faith and local church context.
Yeah, you know, because there would be a kind of evangelical, you know, Don Collett is a student of mine and a colleague. He wrote a nice book on figuration, and he worries a lot about this. He will talk to me in the way people are feeling cramped in their institutions and things and say, you know, we've only got a kind of Christotelic model here. The Old Testament is shooting arrows out beyond itself and landing them on a target out there. It doesn't. Jesus isn't shooting any arrows himself from the first side of this thing, and that's not the way the tradition has typically handled that. That's a legacy of the story model or whatever. But you know, I think you, from the way you process what I think I'm saying, I think you understand my concerns at that point. The Old Testament, that's one of the things I tried to do in the end of, I think maybe Elder Testament. You know, what was the most cited text in early church fathers and early discussions about the nature and person and work of Christ? Proverbs 8.
Yeah.
You know, who'd have thunk? I mean, it's not like, well, you have a New Testament. Why don't you just give them John 1 or something like that? And no.
Yeah.
Now, why? Why was that going on? That's the kind of thing that really interests me.
Yeah. Well, I've learned a lot from the way you phrase the Old Testament is not only what the New Testament makes of it. And you're thinking about just the Old Testament as Christian scripture on its own terms.
It seems to be catching on. You know, I've been invited to a conference in Rome next year that's called, the Old Testament is Christian scripture. So. We will all live long enough to see some things change that we think are productive, and the horizons of God's own disposing are still always way out beyond us. Mm-hmm. And lest one get discouraged. You know, sort of like, can you imagine being told, make them hear and not hear, see and not see, shut up their hearts. But Isaiah didn't go out and complain. He just said what needed to be said. And then someone said later, bind it up. It'll be for the later day. Bind it up. And then later their eyes will be opened. You just go about doing what you need to do. That was a very child's kind of comment. You know, whenever you want to start complaining about your students or your institutions, you know, he would always say, you know, just put the food down and let God go to work. You know, you're not in management, you're in sales, you know. Well, I hope that was an edifying piece of you had a comment here about our world today. Well, and of course the world's blown up around us. Sure. Now I think it's always helpful too to remember that for most of the life of the church, you know, there've been cataclysmic cultural events, the Black Death killing a third of a population and things. We just kind of used to turning on the TV. And so at least I try to comfort myself with this.
Yeah. That's similar to what Martin Luther said of preach the word and then go to sleep, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. They asked, and apparently they asked the Pope one, maybe it was John Paul the 23rd, you know, he said, I'm going to bed tonight, God. It's your church.
Yeah.
I've done what I could do. I'm going to bed.
Well, Dr. Seitz, it was an honor and pleasure to talk to you today. Your body of work has definitely been formative for me in my early days as a doctoral student, but it's also produced many helpful conversations in the classroom and among colleagues. So very much appreciated.
Welcome. It's a pleasure to be able to sit down again and also look at some of the things I've thought about that you tend to forget them, you know. Yeah. That's why you continue to write another book, and so you've got to keep the thing moving along. But it's been really great to talk to you, and I appreciate the time, and I hope it's of some use in God's kingdom.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'm glad that you're here with me here at the end of this episode. If you're still listening, you might be interested in three ways you can support me in the podcast. The first is what you've already done. Listen to this podcast. This year, I'm also writing a weekly newsletter on the canonical approach to biblical studies. So if you're interested in this, you can follow along at chedspellman.substack.com. The second way would be to read, rate, or review any of my books on amazon.com or Goodreads. These are always welcome and are very helpful. My most recent book is An Introduction to the Life and Writings of Irenaeus, an important theologian in the early church. There's a link in the show notes if you're interested. Finally, if you're so inclined, you can buy me a coffee, which is essentially a digital tip jar. Any of these tips go to offset the cost of producing this podcast. You can find a link to this option in the episode description as well. At any rate, Deo Volente, and if the creek don't rise, I'll see you next time. Grace and peace. This episode is partly sponsored by Cedarville University's Graduate School. Cedarville offers over 33 programs in business, leadership, pharmacy, nursing, athletic training, and ministry. Offered both online and on campus, these programs will equip you for ministry and help you succeed in your career, all within your own schedule. To learn more about Cedarville University's graduate degree programs, including the Master of Divinity program that I teach in, go to cedarville.edu/gradpodcast.
I regret to announce this is the end.